On the job, every minute counts. That's why Lowe's now has ProBlock Quick Dry Primer, expertly manufactured by Sherwin-Williams. Engineered for pros to dry fast and go on smooth for virtually flawless results that keep your job moving. It's available in oil and water-based, and getting it is easy. Order online by 2 p.m. and get free same-day delivery right to your job site. Lowe's, we help you save. Orders placed after 2 p.m. will be delivered next day. Valid in select zip codes. Subject to driver availability. More terms apply.
If needlework is your passion, whether you're stitching by hand, machine, or mixing it all up, you're going to want to hear about the Mr. X Stitch Contemporary Needlework Prize 2025. This prize celebrates the best in modern stitch, and it's open to creatives from all around the world. Whether you're a student or an emerging artist or a seasoned professional. And the best part, you don't have to send your work anywhere. Just upload high-resolution images to a private folder we will send you after you enter. You can enter more than one category, for instance, hand embroidery and 3D textiles. Just grab an entry for each one. And if you've got a student ID, you can get 50% off the entry price as well. The deadline for entering is 30th of June 2025, and entries are now open at xstitchmag.com/prize-entry. Thanks to our brilliant sponsors, Bookmarked Hub by Search Press and David and Charles, and the legends at Lowry Workstands. If you've got the stitch bug, this is your time. Show us what you've got. Enter the prize now. Visit xstitchmag.com/prize-entry. to get your ticket today.
Aaron Fine is a former architect who has become a machine embroidery textile sculptor, creating installation pieces that inspire conversation and are very thought-provoking. In this second part of our needle exchange, we discuss Aaron's journey as a textile artist and how his work has evolved, from using monochrome designs to incorporating dyes and colours which have added a depth and richness to his work. He also shares his experience of embracing freeform creativity and the liberation, some people call it terrifying liberation, that it brings. But Aaron highlights the value of having a purpose behind each of his artworks. And we look at how his background in architecture and some of the projects that he undertook were laying the foundations for the work that he's doing now. As expected, in the second part, we have those cultural touchpoint conversations, and we talk about Aaron's practice of Tai Chi, something that has kept him grounded for many years. I really enjoyed talking to Aaron. When I first saw his work in the Mr. X Stitch Contemporary Needlework Prize last year, I was taken by his intelligent approach to form and how the piece that won the Machine Embroidery Prize used light as a means of creating illusion. It was an interesting look at machine embroidery and something that he plays upon with skill and precision. And he's just a really nice guy who's making really nice work, and I think you'll enjoy this part of the conversation. If you do enjoy it, if you'd like to leave a review on your podcasting platform, that would be fab, and hopefully that'll inspire other machine embroidery types to come and have a listen as well. I'll be back next week with another needle exchange with a different artist. In the meantime, enjoy the show. You said fairly early on that you didn't really, well, obviously you've not got much of a prior stitching heritage. I mean, can you, like, when you were a kid, were you kind of, you must have been a creative sort to want to go into architecture, I would have thought.
Yeah, you know what I would do? I would go to the craft store and get, like, you know, pom-poms and googly eyes and make characters and stuff like that. But, like, never really, I don't remember ever really sewing anything, you know.
What kind of stuff did you like to make when you were younger?
You know, kind of just anything, like anything that, like, I'm such a kinetic kind of learner that anything I can kind of put together, like, that's how I understood the world. And it kind of goes back to what I said about, just as a sculptor, it's like, well, I just come up with an idea and try and find, well, you know, that's the thing. I always struggle with this because it's not just like, oh, I came up with the idea. Sometimes I'm just playing with things and materials, and it's like, then it gives me an idea that loops back and is like, how do I kind of expand on this? We would make, we make weapons and stuff like that. You know, you're young boys, you're like, how do we do all this stuff? And my brother was the one who would make the intricate like models and stuff of airplanes and ships. And when he outgrew them, he gave them to me, and all I would do was destroy them. But, but like, you know, for making my own stuff, I would just, you know, it was always just a kind of way to explore and discover the world.
And did you follow that through when you became an architect? Because I don't know. I remember wanting to be an architect and then learning how long it takes to become an architect and then deciding I didn't want to be an architect anymore because it was too much. But it feels like a lot of architecture is grounding dreams in reality and that thing of, you know, you can build a building that looks like a cloud, but it's got to have foundations, work that one out, and then sort of extrapolate. Is that the kind of thing that you're talking about as well?
Yeah, I mean, I just never got so deep into the profession myself, because I think I was always, I just sitting at the desk, and the patience that would take to see if that would pay off into, you know, creative freedom. I just went for the things that I could just, again, my hands could touch this stuff and I can do it. So I just kind of scrabbled my way through to make it work that way. But yeah, like like on my website, like you said, there are these, smaller installation projects that were very much about like creating like a wall out of string and threaded rod. It was just, like three threaded rods. And then those rods have a spiral on it. And like that spiral became the path for a single piece of twine that would go around, and would, because all the threads were, you know, a line going down, you get a very straight, you know, a series of parallel lines that created a surface. And then what that surface did was kind of acted a little bit like glass, where if light was reflecting off it, it just, you couldn't see through it. And then if light was behind it, you know, you would see through it. So, you know, for me, it's like that idea of subverting materials or transforming them into some other realization was, I think that's what really drives me, is like just this discovery of finding something unexpected in materials.
Did you ever have a spirograph as a kid? I don't even know if they have those in America.
I remember buying the spirograph for my kids when they were like, 7 or 8 for, 1 year for their birthdays, because I thought like, hey, this is, this is such a cool toy. And I definitely remember having them and using them.
I feel like I think we've got one of those, and I really feel like I want to get it out. I'm probably going to get more out of it than my children are by a long shot. But so then the interesting thing, like, because I've done a bit of digitized embroidery. I know what you mean about, you just stare at it when you first get one for a long time. And I remember using it to try and do cross stitch. And I also learned as well that if you stop staring at it, the chances of it snarling up on you exponentially increase. I don't know what that is, whether it's just bad luck or whatever. But the interesting thing about digitized embroidery, and the thing that I see that the connection for you, is that a lot of it is about engineering and about surface tension and about distortion and about all those kind of factors. So it feels like, in a way, the architecture and all the things that you've gone through are a perfect training for the fundamental principles of these design. Have you found that you've really taken to it because you've already kind of learned a lot of this physical law stuff?
I would say that's probably a given. And I just remember realizing at a certain point, that like, the thread is my, like, that's my lowest common denominator. I can't, unless you get a thin thread size, and I can go a little bit lower with that, but you can't fight that. Like, you're never going to make something, so intricate that it's going to overcome the dimensions of that thread. So when you're dealing with it, you have to deal with that. And, the early part of doing the embroidery was learning about if you put too much thread on top of each other, it's going to snarl and break because it's too tight. It heats up and, it's not possible. And, And I think part of the my craft and, like, you know, the thing that I kind of push myself on is, like, how few layers can I do? Like, how, how simple can I make it and still get the effects I want without having to belabor it by, like, oh, I'm going to layer up. Because one of the actual really interesting things that I found with the embroidery, especially when I switched over to the industrial machine, was it was almost like working as a printmaker, where you get a hoop, you hoop something, and if your fabric's good and taut, especially if you're using synthetic fabric, it's like a drum. It doesn't distort. I could stitch something, take it off, leave it for a while, and then think about some other stuff, and then go back and do it, and add more layers to it. And that started to really help when I would say like 2019 or so, I discovered I can paint on the threads and dye them. That was like a real kind of turning point for me, because I went on this, did an artist residency that I was invited to. I don't know if you ever heard of it. It's Aramont Pentaculum. It's in Tennessee, right. At the Aramont School. And they said, do you want to come and be in the fiber group? And what was interesting was, like, I had never worked around other fiber artists, because I didn't get schooled in that. And then I did it myself. And so I went, and I was in a group of about five or six people who all were doing different things. And a couple of them were dying, dying wool threads, just whatever. And I was like, huh. I went down with, a bunch of pre-stitched stuff that I thought, oh, maybe I'll, like, collage this, or, because I wasn't bringing my machine. I was just going to bring raw material and see what happened. And then I was just dunking stuff in dye baths. And what I discovered there was, it wasn't my discovery, but people pointed out to me, but it was, natural fabrics and fibers take dye, and synthetic ones resist them. And, here I have the capability of working with, synthetic fabrics as underlays or natural fabrics as underlays. And I have the option to use synthetic threads or natural threads or a mix of both. And again, it was just this whole new realm of saying, like, how can I introduce color into this? And like, what variables can I play with to get different effects? So to go back to that idea of working as a printmaker on the machine, I would start to stitch something out, paint on some of the threads in one color, then go back, stitch more white threads, and then paint another color, and, start to use the machine and its ability to layer and this new technique in there. But, like, the what was interesting about the painting also was, as I was developing early on and kind of doing the geometric stuff, the light stuff, and starting to make canvas pieces, frame canvas pieces. And I started to get feedback from people in the art world about it. One of the things I heard was, like, this feels a little mechanical. It doesn't feel like the artist's hand is in this. And, it stung a little, because it's like, well, you don't know how much going into, like, figuring this out and, like, how much goes into making these things. But, it was fair criticism, because it's their reading of it. And then that discovering the ability to paint on this really did let me introduce that element of the hand and the unexpected, because that's something I always struggled with. Like, I'm, good at the technical part and good at the kind of imagining and kind of designing, like an architect. Like, you design it and then you kind of produce it. But I was always much more hesitant, cautious, uptight, you pick the word, to, like, just do something free on it. And now I had kind of created a structure that of, like, a geometry or bones to what I was making, that I felt confident enough to then do this other freeform stuff on, which added to the effect of the light, because if you have a gradation of color going over something, your eye is starting to see gradation from the start, and then as you move along, it's starting to change more and more because of the light. So it definitely reinforced what I was doing to begin with, and made it richer, I thought.
Yeah, that's interesting, because the minute you start putting, like you say, dyes, and that means you have to consider what materials you're using, in a way you're just adding layers of risk into the process, aren't you? Because prior to that, I guess mono color, monochrome, whatever kind of designs is low risk, isn't it? It's kind of like you're just doing the one thing in a certain way, and there's a safe space for experimentation, which I guess is akin to some of the things you were saying before about being a designer, because you can plan it out and it can be machine precisely and all that sort of thing. Whereas now you're taking these steps of being like, okay, let the die fall where it may, and that kind of thing.
Right.
How do you feel about that? Is it terrifying, or are you just going, well, just go for it?
Yeah, no, it's really liberating, because, you know, I always kind of, yeah, do I say I wanted to do it? I mean, I felt like I can do it, but I just needed some sort of framework in which I could, you know, justify it, understand it, you know, so it's not just like totally random. Like, I don't like doing random stuff. I like there being a purpose for like everything I'm doing. And I feel like I had a good natural color sense that I never got to exercise.
And you'd also built up such a foundation of understanding about the mechanics of the machine stitch and the fabric tension and that kind of thing, that you're experimenting with something that's familiar, isn't it? It's not like you're going straight out the bat and going, right, I'm going to make ice sculptures with a chainsaw, never ever done it before, that sort of thing.
Right, exactly.
Yeah. How do the ideas come now? Because I know that you've still done quite a few pieces of work that are very much connected to current events and to your own experiences and stuff. Is that the theme that underpins a lot of your work, like your journey through life and your perception of the world around you? Is that how you feel it goes?
No, I mean, I feel like now I'm kind of more into the, like the geometry stuff that I'm doing now, the forms. I feel like it's pushing something that's more universal, like, you know, forms that just feel like they could exist in the world, even though they're kind of made up or imagined, or this, you know, I'm trying to remember if at some point I thought to myself, you know, because this is like glass, I kind of want it to feel like a window, and like I was, you know, pushing that for a while. And then, you know, once it was, you know, I think this piece right here is like where, you know, I was able to dye this piece of linen, you know, do this geometry on it. And, you know, I pre-dyed those turquoise squares. I, you know, that was separate. Then I appliqued them on, and suddenly like all the elements started to come together to feel like, okay, now I feel like I'm getting at some of this stuff I wanted to try to get at with architectural, you know, stained glass type thing. But to, you know, kind of create a sense of peace on the work, you know, some, you know, just calm, you know, which I was going for with the flags, but that was so charged in other ways. But this is just, you know, more of an abstract representation of that for me.
Yeah. And I mean, that's fair, because I think I know I did a needle exchange with Jack Roberts, JPR Stitch, and his work is just abstract. And I think what it takes a lot of nerve, I think, personally, to do abstract work, because you're not, it is conceptual. It's not very literal. People can interpret it in whichever way they want. But in the same way, that's the beauty of it, isn't it? Because you're not particularly pushing forward a message. You're just saying, this is my offering to you. And I guess as well, you're looking at the simplicity of the shapes and the forms, which in and of themselves don't come with any baggage necessarily. So I guess it is just, yeah, you're just offerings.
Yeah. And when I was an undergrad and in, you know, I did like art and sculpture as an undergrad, I remember thinking like, oh man, abstract work terrifies me, because who am I to do something like that and call it art, you know? And And so again, like it actually, my first artistic inspiration was architectural scaffolding, you know, because I like lived in New York when I was young, and you go around the city and, you know, Christo, the guy who wraps all the buildings, right? You know that guy, that sculptor?
Yeah.
So these were like kind of Christo sculptures, because they'd have temporary structures. They'd be have like this mesh on them. They'd catch the light and shadows of other buildings. And conceptually, it was really cool, because then they'd, you know, these were temporary structures. They'd come apart and then be kind of mixed up, and they'd appear in different parts around the city. So it was like this architectural common denominator. And, you know, I started, like, that was how I first started to kind of address ideas in art and say, like, here's something I'm trying to get at. And I was, you know, somewhat literal in it. I mean, I just make these repetitive sculptures and stuff like that, and like, in it as like analogous to scaffolding. But again, that's just because I had nothing inside me that was like, okay, I'm just going to do the swoosh. Like, because that's not there.
Have you seen, there's a program called How To with John Wilson. He's a New York documentary maker who films literally everything. And then he's done three series of this show. I think it might come out on HBO, but I watched it over here. And they're different topics, and it's kind of meandering the way it works out. But the second episode in the first series was called How To Put Up Scaffolding. And it was very much looking at that thing in New York of saying, you don't realize how much scaffolding there is until you pay attention to it. And then you realize that it is everywhere, right, you know, and it's part so many buildings that like scaffolding is part of the building because it kind of has to be. And then laws change about the structures of buildings and all of that kind of thing. And it's like, it is that thing. It's like, there's an element of creation that's bolted onto all these things that not a lot of people notice, but when you do, you can't stop seeing it all the time.
Right.
I think you'd very much enjoy that program.
I will definitely look that one up. In fact, actually, after college, when I graduated, I applied for and got a very small travel grant to go to China. And the idea was to look at their use of bamboo for scaffolding, because it was, you know, they would just 70-story skyscraper, and their scaffolding was just bamboo lashed together with these plastic ties. And I mean, that was incredible, like from a physical standpoint and from like a aesthetic standpoint. But what, you know, interested me, because I was always like obsessed with like these little modules and like the repetitive pieces, what, you know, became the thrust of that project was like, oh, what's it like when a culture builds scaffolding with this thing that they use for so many other, you know, uses, like, and you know, so I just went and basically toured around and photographed stuff. And, you know, that was in the 90s before China just really, you know, modernized. So, yeah, exactly. But they still do. They still do the bamboo scaffolding.
Right. Yeah. Do you think we can expect a bamboo series? Spin forward 10 years. Aaron's all about the bamboo.
I lived in one of the houses we lived in Charlottesville, had a bamboo grove. So I made some stuff with it, but mostly it was just like keeping it back because it grows like crazy.
Yeah, it does. It grows like bilio, doesn't it?
Yeah, right.
What else? What other questions did I have? To be honest, I think I've run through all my main questions. Here we go. Tips for people who want to do digitized machine embroidery, and tips for people who want to unlock the power of their sewing machine. Have you got like your top three tips for making good use of your machine?
I think it depends entirely on how, like, do they want to use pre-designed patterns, or do they want to like explore? Because I probably used, besides the stars for that American flag, I probably stitched one pre-designed pattern. Like in all the years I've been doing this. So I don't know that world. I mean, what I would say is maybe it's good to use those to learn stuff. You know, although I think, you know, those usually come as stitch files, so they're a little harder to pick apart, but you could probably get in there and see, you know, how it works. maybe that's the thing. Maybe it's like, you know, using, you know, find some pre-stitch pattern you like and really pay attention to how it stitches. Because again, it's a construction project. It's layered in a certain way. It's, you know, lines are formed in a certain way. And that's, you know, when these pre-stitch patterns look good, they look good for a reason because they're well-crafted. So, you know, that's one way of learning. You know, it's like, what is that, Scott Joplin, who learned to play piano from like those player pianos with the rolls. He would just have it play and then he'd follow along with his fingers. And that's how he learned. Right. So like that's one thing. And then if, I mean, I think the other is like, if you wanted to make your own stuff, just, you know, find some idea, you know, it could be like the simplest idea possible, but try to translate that idea into some element of stitching. You know, it could be a character, it could be, you know, text, it could be, you know, nature, but, you know, think about like what the expression you're going for is, and then how the lines that you're afforded that you can make, or even if you're doing freeform, like haven't really done freeform, you know, digital embroidery, but, you know, an idea is always going to be the thing that kind of carries you through with interest. I mean, it's very hard to maintain interest if you're not trying to reach a goal because you have something in your head, I think, at least for me.
There's, do you think it's worth, like, for beginners, because sometimes it can almost be you're learning a new technology and trying to think of a new idea could be really difficult. So you could get off just recreating a logo that you've seen or something like that, isn't it? You know, just something that you don't have to burn your soul to create in the first place, you know?
Yeah. And it's, I mean, that's, I think much of the history of art is like copying something and seeing how it was made. So, and it's a great, like, there's such versatile machines that, you know, like, and people are going to have different interests going in. Like mine, you know, I said, I narrowed it down to like that white thread, but like, maybe it's the colors, you know, that are drawing people in. You know what, I got to say, the thing about the domestic machine that was really gives a lot more flexibility than an industrial machine is, I could go in, you know, like create some pattern and then go in the software and just delete all the stitch points between like the ends. And then you just get these really long threads. And like, I really like that. I kind of miss that because I just don't get on that machine anymore.
I'm going to do a shout out to my man, Eric Campbell, who used to write a column for Mr. X Stitch called Ghost in the Embroidery Machine.
Yeah. I follow him.
Yeah, his YouTube channel, he does it somehow. I mean, A, what he knows about, like, digitized embroidery, he knows everything.
Right.
He's also amazingly managed to do, at current count, 190 weekly podcasts about machine embroidery and yet doesn't seem to be tired yet or something. He's got so much to learn. So I think, yeah, for anybody who needs to understand any of the technology and also, like, the philosophy and stuff, I think Eric's a great resource to go on there. I'm guessing you quite enjoy digging around inside that software then and kind of coming up with structures and seeing what you can achieve.
Yeah. And that's like when I made that jump from the domestic machine and the software that came with it, which was, you know, at best rudimentary, to I use Wilcom and it's, you know, it gives a level of control, you know, where you can isolate things from something else so you can get at other aspects of it, and it can do quite a bit. And when I was searching for the ideas I wanted to push, like, it had the capability to do those things and then some. And so I've been a big fan of that software, and it's been very, you know, stable and reliable and versatile.
Yeah, shout out to Wilcom as well, because I know they give a lot back to, like, the machine embroidery sector as well.
Yeah,
I know
that. Definitely.
Do you find there's much of a difference between what you plan to make and what actually comes out at the back, or have you got that pretty well nailed down?
It's, you know, when it, I think when it's good, you're still discovering things. I have a writer friend that says, you know, no surprise for the writer, no surprise for the reader. You mm-hmm. know? So it's like, if you can still, you know, come up with things that are, you know, new to you, then that'll be good for the viewer. And I gotta say, I'm kind of pathological when it comes to not being able to do the same thing over and over again. Uh-huh. Like, and it's, it comes at a cost, you know, to like, it's that same impulse, like, oh, I'm just going to do the next thing and learn the next thing. And,
but at least in this instance, you're doing different things within a larger, broader context that may have some economical stability underpinning
right,
it.
Right. And that, and that's, you know, was always a sense of like, here's like a, not just a skill set I'm building, but like a process that I'm building. And this process can be scaled, whether I'm ambitious enough to actually do that. Like, you know, with, you know, if I had, you know, staff on the machines, like I could do more digitizing. Like, I don't know if I'd ever get there, but like, I kind of built that into the process as something that, that is potential. But like I said, not sure if I'm the guy to actually pull that off.
Although one day when we come along and you've wrapped a building in a thing again, we will understand what exactly. we say. Right. I'm going to move on to some tricky questions now. Now we've done all the easy, let's talk about art process and all that sort of stuff. Do you have a favorite band?
Yes, I do. Humphreys McGee.
Okay.
Not sure if you've ever heard them. They are like a, let's say kind of a metal-ish jam band, which it's like if Ozzy Osbourne and the Grateful Dead had a baby. And my best friend got me into them. And, you know, they're a touring band. And you can get all, like, there's an app called Nugs.net, N-U-G-S.net, where they have tons of artists and their live shows. And this band has, you could pretty much get every show they've done for 25 years. And, you know, they've never repeated a set. It's kind of like me. Wow. Like, don't want to do the same thing over and over again. But, you know, the sound that they create is intense. And, you know, it's a great joy. And also for my best friend who got me into this, we always had a hard time keeping in touch. And because of this band, we're always sending stuff back and forth to each other. So it's actually been a really great part of life to have these days.
Do you listen to music while you're working?
Yeah, definitely. Definitely. It, you know, although I find it hard to sew on a sewing machine, like if I'm using a serger or a sewing machine, because the sound of what's happening is really important. Because, you know, you can, you know, things go wrong in sound. Like you can hear it before you see it, I think. And so I find like I can't have headphones on when I'm sewing. You know, I can have it on in the background kind of low, but I do like to work with music.
Do you think we could play a game where we play the sounds of stitches and we can tell whether you think they're in good shape or not?
I know, right?
Start to make you twitch because you know something's going awry somewhere or something.
Exactly.
I like it. Do you have a favorite book, or what was the last good book that you read?
The last good book I read was by a British journalist, Douglas Murray, on the War on the West.
Okay.
Really interesting stuff. It's you know, it is, I will just say that, like, it was
thought-provoking.
Thought-provoking, for sure.
The twist at the end. It turns out it was a romantic comedy.
I know, right? Exactly.
Do you listen to podcasts much? Obviously, other than Needle Exchange.
I have done some podcasts. Sometimes I find it hard to get into it, but I've been a fan of Sam Harris's podcast, Making Sense, these days. I don't know if you know that one.
But I know of him because he appears on all the other ones, doesn't he? All the Lex Friedmans and all those kind of If you ever want to listen to someone talk for 3 hours,
right,
put the words Lex Fridman or, oh God, who's, oh, Andrew Huberman, or just all of the like big talkers, isn't it? They go on for ages.
Yeah.
I haven't quite got to that level yet. Okay. What I was going to ask you ages ago was, there's a guy on YouTube, and I think he's called Stephen Machine. I was going to ask you how you feel about Rube Goldberg machines, because I feel like they might appeal to you.
Anytime I see a video start, I have to watch it finish. And I do, like, yeah, those things are pretty incredible. It's funny. I feel like, yeah, growing up, you asked me, like, what I like to make. I think there was always an element of, like, a Rube Goldberg machine in there. Like, how do you kind of do something that's going to, like, make some other thing happen? Definitely.
Whenever I watch them, because like I said, I found a couple of guys on YouTube recently. There's one guy who's got like 3 million subscribers or whatever. And whenever I see them, I'm so jealous because I really wish I could have the time to make those stuff, because sometimes they're just so bloody clever,
right,
you know,
right.
And it's not even like trick shots. It's just those, you know, the fun ways they can make connections between different things, doing different things and all those kind of things. I thought, thought that would appeal.
And the domino setups, those I like too.
I feel like the stress of those. I mean, I know with a lot of these Rube Goldberg machines, they'll kind of like take 35 is the one that eventually works or whatever. But with the dominoes, yeah. I like watching them with my kids as well, because they are just a little bit mind-blowing. And also, I'm saying the likelihood of doing a domino roll in my house is very small. Too much carpet, quite frankly. Right. And then film or TV show, last good or favorite?
Well, Spinal Tap. Probably favorite. It just like applies to every aspect of life. There's always a moment where you're like, and that correlates with that. Last good one. You know, which was a great one from last year was called You Hurt My Feelings with Julia Louis-Dreyfus. It's about creativity. It's about a woman who is a writer and she's working on a book. And she happens, like, she sees her husband with a friend in a store, and she's like sneaking up on him or about to come up on him. And she hears that he's telling his friend, like, oh, her book sucks. And it's just an area of human experience that I've never seen done in a film and done very, very well.
Excellent. That does sound, yeah, yeah. God, that's dangerous, isn't it? I don't, well, I mean, thankfully, my wife's work is just purely marvelous. I say that in case she's listening. So, how does your family enjoy your work? Just out of interest.
It's been a real nice bonding thing for me and my kids, because they became, you know, they're makers in their own right. And I remember, like, for them, it was always costuming. They were just into superheroes and stuff like that growing up. And I would, try and show them just techniques along the way. And then there's a point when I guess my older son was probably like 11 or so. And I had, taught him how to score cardboard with an X-Acto knife. And he's like, it's okay, Dad. I got it. And I'm like, I had to walk away and just hope he didn't cut his finger off. He didn't. And I know, like with my younger son too, like whenever I am working on something, I will show it to him and like we just discuss the ideas. And that's been a very rich give and take. So definitely, enjoy that part of parenting quite a bit.
How do you feel about the sort of context that you're in? Because textile arts, and particularly when you're talking like large scale applique, quilting, that kind of territory being very much an American tradition as well. How do you feel about being part of that equation?
It's always been interesting. Like, there was always the kind of, the novelty factor of being a guy doing this, traditionally it's, a female centered craft, and in one sense it gives you like a again, a little novelty that you can kind of use to your advantage. But at the same time, you know, I've met just a lot of interesting people, you know, men and women who do it. And it's been interesting also to see, you know, when I started it, doing, you know, textile stuff, you know, textiles wasn't not nearly as kind of a hot medium as it has become. So that's been encouraging to see that I've like, you know, picked a good field. Again, my level of ambition though might be the only thing, you know, standing in my way of pushing it to certain levels. But
it always amuses me how sometimes it's like, I once did a workshop where we were stitching lyrics onto chairs in a pop-up shop in Camden in London, and it was like about the coolest thing on the planet at that precise moment in time, you know. And then half an hour later it just goes back to being like a little old lady craft, where it's so funny how it can be, right, you know, in the right setting.
Well, that actually, when I started doing the flags, you know, the place where I went to get my machine and kind of learn about it was inside of like a Joann's Fabrics. It's a chain in the States. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they had a partnership with Husqvarna, so they would have machines in there. And yeah, all the people I interacted with were like, you know, women over 60. And, you know, so I was always a bit of an outlier in that sense.
But there'll also be the ladies, I bet, who some of them truly appreciate the stuff you're doing with the light and the shimmer and the direction and all that, because they just know it. And it's not necessarily something you can just talk about with your friends down at the local coffee shop or whatever. Right. So there must be some people who just really love it.
Yeah. And what was interesting was when I would go and stand out with those flags early on, I noticed like people would just instinctively want to reach out and touch it. Like mm-hmm. for that tactility. And it's, and as someone who, you know, my background was as much architecture as art, like I was never like an art world person. And mm-hmm. I always found, you know, galleries to be a bit standoffish and, you know, stuffy. And I really liked that aspect, that people felt so connected tactily to the medium. And it was one of the reasons that I thought, like, this is a good medium to go into, because there is this natural attraction to it. And it's not the like, standoffish.
I think that's really important. And I think there's also this fundamental, like, most people can kind of understand how you've made it. Maybe not to a really great degree, but, you know, any of this stuff with the needle and thread, it's so familiar mm-hmm. as a global culture or whatever that it does. It automatically engenders people, endears people, one of those two.
Yeah.
No direction.
Yeah. There's just, I think, like an innate connection to it.
Mm. Is there an interesting fact that not a lot of people know about Aaron Fine?
The people that I know it, but like in terms
people
of,
listening to this podcast, on the other hand.
Yeah. Like from a professional standpoint, like one of the main things in my life is a long time practice of Tai Chi. And that's been, yeah, very, very deep ongoing thing that I think informs the work I do as well. You know, I would say also from that conceptual standpoint of, remember that I mentioned that project of the string wall, where it was the threaded rods and the string. Like, to me, that had like all those elements of yin and yang, where you have like rigid rods and flexible string, and then when you put them together, the string becomes flexible, and then the rods soften because they're covered with string, and there's just always this interplay of opposites. And, you know, that is a very important part of my work is this interplay of opposites.
How long have you been practicing Tai Chi?
Since before 9/11, I remember that. I started when I was actually... Remember I said I went to China, I discovered it right before my trip. I was trying to learn some, you know, Chinese language. And I went to a place where they were doing demonstration classes of different things. And I saw a woman doing Tai Chi, and I said, I have to do that. And been going ever since.
I did it for a year back in the day. This would have been like 2003, something like that. And it also coincided with me being a town councillor in my local town.
Wow.
And for a while, I was also the chair of the planning committee. It's not a big town, so being the chair of the planning committee is more like, does this single story extension, you know, whatever. But the way it would work is we would do Tai Chi at 6 p.m. on a Wednesday, and the town council meetings were at 7 p.m. on a Wednesday. So I was so chilled when I went to those meetings. It was unbelievable. I was virtually unruffleable. And I just loved it. I loved the fact that, like, you... Obviously, it's more nuanced, but you'll never be perfect at Tai Chi, right? Because there's always something. There's always a little bit more of kind of breathing and placement and all of that kind of stuff.
For sure. Yes, actually, I've had for 7 or 8 months now this problem with my neck, and I'm just like, keep trying to work through it. But like, I think part of it is like, well, I'll just keep doing the practice, and hopefully someday that'll dissipate. But at least I have my full range of motion, and maybe I wouldn't if I wasn't doing the practice. So,
And there is probably there's a bit of a kind of slowness as well in the production of your art, isn't it? There's a sort of an in and out and a breathing and a sort of just, you can't do it at a pace, can you?
No, it doesn't get rushed. I mean, can't get rushed.
And that's probably quite nice. Do you enjoy the journey of making it?
Yeah. Like I say that, the process of going through something repetitive, which I have to do, like if I'm making a shape that has, you know, 1,000 little shapes in it, and I have to, you know, just like go click on a bunch of things, select them, you know, do a transformation to them, go to the next thing, do that, like that, even before I started Tai Chi, like that type of work was very soothing to me. And it was, you know, I learned, you know, when I was later in life diagnosed ADHD, that you develop coping mechanisms for, you know, how you work. And those are just definitely coping mechanisms. And they, you know, like I said, they soothe and they also get me somewhere.
Fab. Hey, Aaron. Thanks for having a needle exchange with me.
Yeah, my pleasure. Absolute pleasure. Been great.
Thanks for joining me on another needle exchange. I hope you enjoyed the show. I'd love to hear from you, so feel free to email hello@needle.exchange. That's needl.exchange with any thoughts, comments, or feedback. And if you want to keep up with all the news, sign up to the Needle Exchange mailing list at bit.ly/needleexchange. See you next time.